Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Learning Well podcast. We have a fun podcast today. Today is our second podcast where we are discussing summer reading, or what we like to call beach reads. So in the world that I live in, I consider a beach read something that I could put down and come back and read 10 minutes later, half an hour later, an hour later, and pick right back up where I started. It also does not require me to have sticky notes, pens, highlighters, or anything like that. So that's where we're headed today. This is our second in a series of beach reads. And today we're looking at a book entitled Millennials, Goldfish, and Other Training Misconceptions by Clark Quinn. But before we get into that, we have two guests today. So first I have Cade, who joined us on the previous podcast where we discussed Think Again by Adam Grant. So Cade, why don't you just reintroduce yourself to maybe our listeners who weren't able to listen to the last one?
Yeah, perfect. So my name is Cade. I'm a solutions architect at Mindspring. My background is a little bit different than a lot of people within our organization. I have a degree in history and French, and then I have a graduate degree in ethnic and immigration studies. My research really focused on policy that was discriminatory towards certain communities, specifically Arab and Muslim communities in the United States. I spent a number of years working for a city around us right here in Grand Rapids, and then I spent some time working kind of as administration in local school districts as well before being at Mindspring. So that's a little bit of my background.
Which all, I think, is a great background. As we discuss this book here in a minute, where each one of us is going to bring a slightly different perspective to these misconceptions, myths, and, you know, that sort of thing. So I'm excited about that. Blaine, so we have Blaine joining us too. I'm so excited to have her join us. Blaine, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so my name's Blaine, and I am a project success manager at Mindspring. And my background is actually in psychology. So my master's was in industrial and organizational psychology with a focus on behaviorism. So a lot of my time in the industry has been spent both as a performance improvement manager as well as an instructional designer. So I've been doing that for about 10 years before I got to Mindspring. But was able to get experience in really large organizations that were international and then really small organizations that were more local and kind of everywhere in between. So really picked up a lot of different experiences in those 10 years.
No, I love that. And Kate and I, we mentioned this the last podcast, but you two are some of my favorite people to talk books and podcasts and other things with. But again, your background is different than Kate's, which is different than mine. And I think that's actually important because when we talk about this book, which again, it's called Millennials, Goldfish, and Other Training Misconceptions, Debunking Learning Myths and Superstitions. Some of these myths, superstitions, in some industries would be considered gospel truth, in others, not at all. And then are we in higher ed? Are we talking about K-12? Are we talking about the corporate world or nonprofits? So I'm really glad to have all of our perspectives here because I think they'll lend something different to this than if we were all just sort of in the same industry. So before we begin, I do want to give just a little bit of a recap. This book, I think, is pretty close to my heart just in terms of the work we've done at Mindspring, just thinking through learning science and trying to dig a little deeper into good scholarship and what really works, good research. So it's important to us that we address beliefs that aren't based on learning science, and they're perpetuated for a variety of reasons. They're easier, maybe just, ignorance, not intentional, that kind of thing. But the other thing I love about this book is that Clark Quinn is, and he's very popular in the industry. I mean, he's very well respected. You can find him on multiple websites and articles and things like that. So he's not just poking holes in things. And we'll talk about the format of the book in a minute. But he really is providing what he calls reconciliation. Like, how can we take what's good about this and then make sure we're applying this in the right way? So the book is divided into three parts. So the first section is myths, you know, things he identifies that are truly not right. Like, they're not right. They're a myth. The second part really is design practices that we just can't really support. Maybe things have changed. Maybe the research has changed, whatever. But then lastly, clarification of beliefs, things that probably are good, but they've just been misapplied. And I will say, I did this on the last podcast too. I like to know pages. Okay, so this book is only 182 pages long. It's a paperback. It's got a goldfish on the front. It's a cartoon, so it's super cute. So to me, it qualifies as a beach read. That's how I qualify it. But Blaine, he also addresses at the beginning, like, who is this book written for? So can you tell us a little bit about, like, who is the audience?
Yeah, so Quinn assumes that this is going to be read by anyone in the learning industry. So that can be anyone from a learning associate all the way through a VP of learning and design. Because, like you said, it is really digestible. It's easy to pick up, but it's also tackling some issues that maybe we've simplified in the industry, and really pulling out that it's a little bit more complex. So we know that learning doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's a part of a system. And so some of these things just can't be, you know, it's always this way, it's always that way. But it really needs to be looked at more as a whole. So everybody who touches learning in an organization should be aware of how those things are affected, because that's how you're going to design it. That's how you're going to develop it. That's how you're going to implement it in the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, this book is very digestible. Mm-hmm. It's very simple format, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But one of the really, I think, part of the point of it is that you might read a chapter on a topic, on a myth, and then it really prompts you to go do more research and read through it more. So that's another big goal. But Cade, how would you recommend that we read this book? Like, tell us a little bit about the format and how we read it. Because I don't think it's one of those start at chapter one and read to the end.
Yeah, definitely. So you do not, as a reader, have to go from beginning to end. This is a book that's really designed for you to take bite-sized pieces and just kind of digest it. Like you said, go back and research it some more. One of the things even that is recommended at the beginning of the book is to find a couple topics that are interesting to you. Really kind of like jump into those places. And it really, like you said, it's a beach read. It's not really meant, it's kind of like a just in time. Oh, I'm interested in this topic. Mm-hmm. Is it in this book? Yep. Okay, cool. I can spend 2 to 3 pages reading and learning a little bit about this as a jumping off point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I there's 37 topics addressed. But he does recommend, and I would say, obviously, like, read the preface, but the first chapter is the myths that hold us back. And then the second chapter is the science of learning. So that is where Clark Quinn is giving sort of this foundation, but then you jump into these 37 topics. Each one of them are at most 3 pages. It's a small book. Each chapter is set up in the same format. So it's set up as the claim, and it's like a sentence, you know, so whatever the myth or the superstition or whatever, he lists that. Then he lists the appeal, which I found really helpful. Like, why do we keep perpetuating this myth or whatever? Why are we wrongly, like, what's appealing about it? And then he'll often say something like, well, what's the upside? What's the downside? Or in other chapters, he'll talk about, like, the reconciliation, in other words. And that's in really the third part. Like, we have these beliefs and they're right, but we're wrongly applying them. So he'll offer a reconciliation. In other words, how can we fix this situation? And then he talks about what to do, and he gives citations, which are beautiful, because otherwise, right, we might even just be perpetuating more myths in these books, but he's providing a citation. And then at the end, for those of us that are in true, I'd say, modeling, right, practicing what you preach, the last section, 161 to the end, is a quick guide, and there is a literal half-page sort of chart that just summarizes each of those chapters. So you could literally pull it off, thumb through, and find those. So I'm a huge believer in modeling and being intentional, which is what I loved about this book. He's practicing what he preaches, even in the design of this book. Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's get started. We've picked 4 today for you. And we're going to start with a doozy. So, Blaine, we're going to start. You were very interested in Kirkpatrick's model of evaluation, which I do want to point out, that falls in the last third of the book, which is misconceptions. So it's a belief, a concept that is a good one, but most likely probably applied wrong. Mm-hmm. So why don't you just talk us through, what does he say about Kirkpatrick's model?
Yeah, so the claim for this one is that the Kirkpatrick model isn't an effective evaluation tool. So for anybody who isn't familiar with Kirkpatrick, it's 4 levels of evaluation. We've got reaction, learning, behavior, and then results. So that's all the way from, did people enjoy the experience?
The reaction,
yeah. Which a lot of times people call like a smile sheet, if you've ever heard that. And then it goes all the way into, did this make an impact on the business? And so a lot of people, the myth is that they believe that it doesn't actually measure learning. It just reinforces what training is. And so people are seeing this as a little bit outdated, not really sure that it's the most effective way to design a learning program. So the counter is really that it's supposed to actually start with level four. So
right. It should be an inverted triangle.
Exactly. Yeah. And Kirkpatrick himself even said, I probably designed them wrong. So one of the things, you know, originally when we were talking about how some of these myths are just, they're very simple and they're seen as simple, but they're actually very complex. And I think that that is very true for this scenario because when people look at the ADDIE model, a lot of times they're seeing it very linear, but it's actually a circle. If you started with evaluation, which is what you should do, and according to this, the counter here, you should start with that level four, and you should do it before you ever start designing your learning program at all. So I want to know, what is it that's going to, that the business needs to be changed? What needs to be different by the end of this learning experience? Well, that plays a part into how I write it, how I design it, how I develop it. If I didn't start with that and I got all the way through the end and then I thought about that, it may be a flop. It may not actually change anything. It is also hard. A lot of organizations, and again, I've been in small ones and I've been in really big ones, and it's difficult to measure those kinds of things without some effort.
It is.
So I think
we just need to solve the problem, design the learning experience, and move on. We don't want to think about designing it backwards.
Right.
What am I trying to measure and designing with that in mind?
And that's a really good point, too, is that it has to be measured. So if an organization isn't currently measuring those things, they just know it kind of doesn't work. Or they know that the end of the process doesn't work, but those middle spots, they're just kind of assuming it's this behavior, and that behavior is probably a learning problem, so it must be the training is the solution.
Yes.
And that, again, is way too simple. So if your organization is measuring those things and you're identifying early on what actually has to change, then you can go back and identify the actual behavior that has to change and write your learning around that.
I'm glad I got the topics I did for this, where I don't need a master's degree to talk about them.
Well, and Blaine, what I think is interesting, too, is when you talked about level one reaction and you gave the classic example of the smile sheets, that's another way that it's been misapplied.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a lot in many organizations for lots of reasons. Again, we're not trying to be critical here, but it's sort of the default. I'm going to give a smile sheet. Did you like what you did?
Right.
Well, I might like what I did. Yeah, it was super fun. And they brought donuts, so that was perfect. But I didn't, my behavior never changed.
Right.
And maybe my behavior didn't change because I know I'm supposed to be doing it this way, but my supervisor doesn't give me the time. That's not even a learning problem, right?
Yeah.
So there's a couple issues there, but you can see that there's a lot of complexity and nuance to the Kirkpatrick model if you apply it correctly. And there's a thousand ways you can evaluate the learner reaction and experience beyond smile sheets.
Yeah.
And so I think there's also that issue, is people aren't quite clear on what evaluation tools I could use at each level. So I default to a simple one, and then I'm not measuring what I really need to measure.
Right. And the same thing is true. I mean, we've talked about one and four, but even if you're looking at level three, which is, did my behavior actually change on the job? That is, again, also hard to measure because it requires you to put in the work to find out if it changed. So it's managers stepping in and watching, did that behavior change? It's, you know, it's just
coaching or mentoring. And
getting client feedback, things like that, that are just, the level of effort is so much harder. So I think the reason that we tend to stay in that one and two is because it's just the responsibility of the learner and the facilitator or the delivery system that it is. So I actually think it's more on the learning industry for sticking with one and two. That's where we actually made a mistake, not in the Kirkpatrick model in general. And I think that level one, you have to think of it too, it's not that any of those levels are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Each of them are great. If you want to change something in an organization, you should really be starting at four. But one, those things can be a distractor. Mm-hmm. Was the room super cold? Was it way too long?
They're important.
Right. Was the facilitator, did they seem a little off today? Those are distractors to a learning environment that I still don't want to be included in what I'm creating. So there's value in all of them. You just have to know that you got to put in a lot more effort for 3 and 4, although the output is then greater too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we never do this on this podcast, but I'm going to do a little bit of a shameless plug. So one of our really big initiatives this year at MindSpring is our learning scorecard, where we're trying to take this model and we built out software and a dashboard to help teams really measure all four of these things and what's the, you know, kind of metric modeling behind it, and are we measuring the right metrics? Are we using the right data sources? So that's a shameless plug. Aside from that, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that we've also added sort of a level below level one, which is we asked a learning team what they think of what they did. Which at first blush, you're like, well, of course everybody's going to be like, super, 5 gold stars for me. But honestly, I often find our learning teams are most critical of their own work, and they know what could be improved and where and how. And that's really important data. Mm-hmm. So, all right, well, this is a conversation we could have for forever, right? But we're actually violating all the rules of a beach read because this is 3 pages and we've talked for 10 minutes. So, no, but there's a lot to be said. Yeah. But Kirkpatrick is an industry standard. The other thing I love is that he does reference a couple other newer models that I think, again, if you're listening, it bears going to look at and seeing how they fit in. But this is something, this chapter in particular, I think was just really helpful for sort of, again, rethinking what maybe we've always assumed about Kirkpatrick's model and really relearning to apply it correctly.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to jump to Cade because you were super interested in brainstorming. And to me, when I heard that phrase, I thought, well, what can be controversial about brainstorming, right? So brainstorming is in the section that is called in the misconceptions section. So I'm curious how he kind of articulates that brainstorming might be a misconception. So in your research and just reading of this, Cade, what did you discover?
Yeah, so just at a very high level, the claim is that brainstorming just simply doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Pulling together a ton of different minds, collaborating together, the output may not be clear. It may not be defined.
The blind leading the blind, or just not helpful?
I think it's more about not helpful.
Okay.
In that you can walk into a brainstorm and then you can walk out with multiple paths, no clear direction, no clear path forward with something like that. So that's the high level claim. The counter to that is just simply that the more brains that we get into the room, the better ideas we can generate, and we can foster healthy conversation and dialogue. And so that's kind of the counter. This brainstorming one seems kind of like, it seems like a lot of this feels like naturally like we would want to brainstorm. So the claim actually seems a little bit backwards to me from here.
Gotcha. Okay, I see. Yep.
I would assume that most people would think brainstorming is really a good thing.
Right. Although, to be fair, maybe it's more of we've all sat in brainstorming sessions where exactly what they said happens. We walk out and we're like, that was an hour I'll never get back.
Totally. So, yeah. And so part of that, I think, is like, how do we have good brainstorming? Yeah. And you know, the reconciliation that he talks about is allowing individual work occur before the brainstorming mm-hmm. session. So I've been a part of a lot of brainstorming sessions in the past in different organizations. And one of the things that I've found really helps is to be able to, I think that individual work is good and healthy, but I think there has to be parameters on what that individual work is asking for. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of brainstorming sessions ask people to come together without telling them what they're coming together to actually do.
Gotcha.
Okay. You know, so it's we're going to brainstorm about X topic. Okay, well, X topic, what are the requirements? Like, what are the baseline things that have to be included? You know, like, what are the nice-to-haves versus the must-haves? Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of brainstorming sessions that aren't productive don't start with the must-haves. They just start open-ended. And then, you know, you keep going back to, you know, whoever's leading it, facilitating it, if there ever is a facilitator.
Right, there's that issue, yeah.
Yep, who leads this, who facilitates. kind of going, oh, well, here's additional information that you didn't know before the brainstorming session. So I think for good, productive brainstorming sessions, there has to be that pre-work, but whoever's facilitating and leading that really needs to be able to demonstrate, like, and explain what it is that people are coming together to actually brainstorm for.
So really, I mean, this is not always the case at all, but sometimes I think brainstorming can be sort of a lazy way of crowdsourcing ideas. And again, the premise is good because you're getting all the people in the room and getting good ideas. But if it's done right, it actually takes more effort is what I'm hearing you saying. Like, we need to give people parameters to begin with and to think about. And when we get people together, like, what are the expectations of this meeting, quote, before we just randomly brainstorm? And like, what output are we looking for? Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, in the industry that we're in, as we're creating digital content all the time, we have a lot of brainstorming sessions that we pull a lot of creative, innovative minds into those conversations. One of the things that we constantly have to do is whoever's facilitating has to anchor everybody back to that. Yes, that is a super creative, super cool, innovative idea, but are we anchoring it in what the ask is here? Mm-hmm. Right. And so, like, you can have the greatest brainstorming session in the world, but unless it's actually meeting the needs mm-hmm. of what your original intent is, I mean, save it, put it in your back pocket, save it for later, but maybe it's not super productive for this session right now.
Well, and that probably begs the question, there's more than one kind of brainstorming session too. So there's a brainstorming that is anchored in what the client needs or my organization needs right now. And so I'm pretty targeting. And then there are those just like we talked about, moonshots, creativity, like what if time and money and like there were no issues, what could we do? And that is probably a situation where we have more freedom to just throw out. I mean, there's no such thing as a bad idea. Whereas when we're working on some constraints and trying to develop something for a client or an organization, I don't want to say there are bad ideas, but there are certainly, like you said, ideas that are not really anchored in what the ask is at this moment. And so they're just not usable.
Yeah, just untenable for right. the situation. Yeah, definitely. Right. But there, I think in this claim that brainstorming doesn't work, it's like everything else. There could be a bad way to do it,
right.
and there could be a really productive and good way to do it. I think a lot of that starts with facilitation and prep work before. Mm-hmm.
No, I love that. And that's a great reminder because it is so easy. I've done it myself. Like, hey, can three of you meet for 15 minutes? Let's just brainstorm. Like, that's literally it. That's mm-hmm. all I do. And that's a lazy way to approach it. So, yeah. I love that. That's a great reminder. And I'm glad he included that because that's a pretty practical, like, that happens at an organizational level all the time. Mm-hmm. So. All right. Well, Blaine, Bloom's taxonomy. I'm a little nervous to approach this because this is like the holy grail here. We're talking about Bloom's taxonomy. But I know that it is also something that is important mm-hmm. for us to discuss. And again, maybe something that's just been wrongly applied yeah. over time.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. So the claim is that Bloom's taxonomy is a useful guide for designing training, which I guess I was surprised by when I started reading this, that the claim was actually that it's useful, mm-hmm. not that it's not useful.
Not useful. Mm-hmm.
So Bloom's taxonomy is really kind of a way to categorize the learning effort that's going to go into it. But the counter to it being a useful piece, Quinn says that it just doesn't include the most up-to-date learning science that we know now, because those levels are just way more complex mm-hmm. than I think originally stated. Also, that it's hard to apply those to actual learning. And then lastly, that the distinctions between those levels just aren't different enough for people to really make a
distinction.
Yeah, they
blur sometimes.
Exactly, mm-hmm. yeah. So they are, just for anybody who doesn't know what Bloom's taxonomy is, those levels are remember, understand, apply, analyze, evaluate, and create. And so it kind of goes from that remember stage is just simply recalling facts or terms, but all the way down to create, which is, can I form a new idea based on the information that I just got? And so I think you can imagine that different kinds of content lend itself better to one of those versus another. So really, like, the reconciliation for it is that, again, it's just too nuanced. There are too many levels of each of those levels to simply say, oh, this is just an analyze one, or this is just an understand one. And that you really have to focus on the task first. Mm-hmm. And I, as a behavior analyst, I absolutely agree. We have to focus on the task first. But I think it's, again, too simple to say, well, this doesn't work, because we always focus on the doing and mm-hmm. what somebody's going to do differently. Whereas I think that you absolutely can have scenarios where you're asking someone to prove that they know this thing or they can do this thing and they can apply that thing, but it may not be any deeper than I do need to just know what that term is or what that fact is. You know, you think through, like, if you've got like a training on core values or on benefits or the company, things like that. I'm not necessarily applying that all the time. Now, can I create a scenario where I do have to pull that out? Absolutely. But if we think about learning, the way that we're designing learning being taking that behavior and then putting the least amount of information that somebody needs in order to do that, I do want to know what level of effort do I want to put in, because mm-hmm. the ask, like Cade was saying with brainstorming, isn't necessarily that you want somebody to throw themselves into 10 different scenarios on our core values and be able to pull all of those out. Now, you might, but maybe I just need you to be able to recall them when the time comes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think probably the issue of the misapplication of Bloom's is that within our industry, people come from a lot of different backgrounds. And if they maybe haven't had the formal training where they're pulling, occasionally we'll bump into an organization or a client that says, are you all certified in this theory? Mm-hmm. And our point is always no, because no one theory, like we have master's degrees in curriculum instruction, organizational psychology, all different types of degrees that help us look at the big picture and all the models. Like often an ask is like, well, do you use ADDIE? Or no, ADDIE's been debunked. You can't use ADDIE. I'm like, well, hold on. You know, that's not, we're taking all of those and we're building the best situation, right. The best experience. And I think that's sometimes what happens with Bloom's, is maybe if you're in an organization where there isn't an understanding of all the models in the broader picture. So it's kind of used as one size fits all. Where I often find the most usefulness, and I use Bloom's all the time, if I'm writing actual objectives, because it's forcing me to think through all the levels that I might want somebody to know, believe, or do about my material. But like you said, I might really literally just only need them to know something.
Right.
I think a lot about compliance training. Mm-hmm. I just need you to be safe, so don't do this. Now, that might be fine. On the other hand, that might be terrible. I actually need you to not only know it, but to know why you shouldn't be doing this, to stay safe, and how to brainstorm, and speaking of brainstorming, and how to create a solution if something goes wrong. So, but it's interesting, I think Bloom's gets wrongly applied often.
I agree. And I think, too, it's back to, you know, it fits within this larger, like, macro system of it. So it isn't just a learning outcome. And I think maybe categorizing Bloom's as just for a learning outcome is actually incorrect.
That's right, yeah.
I still use it, too. And I think of it more as how am I going to assess that somebody knows how to do this? For you, is it recalling facts or is it problem solving? Mm-hmm. Great. Now I know which of those I'm going to focus on, and that's how I'm going to write the overall, you know, content that we're creating. But by no means have I pulled out the behavior just because they might need to recall a fact.
Absolutely. Like we often say, and this is a simplification, but what do you need to know, believe, and do?
Right.
Again, big simplification, but it's a useful construct. And I always argue for, it's very rarely just one of those. There's probably one that's the main one, but it's never just one of those.
Right.
So, cool. Okay. So, again, there's a lot of good information in that chapter. It might drive you to do some more research on your own. Cade, you know, we attacked the Holy Grail with Bloom's, but we are also probably, I don't want to say attacking the Holy Grail with your topic, multitasking. I would just say that it's something that we all think we do. And we all think we do it amazingly well, but I'm interested mm-hmm. to hear your thoughts on multitasking.
This is a topic that's actually like really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the claim is that multitasking, that we can actually effectively do that.
Yeah, and it's actually in the myth part of his book. I do want to point that out. So he considers this a myth. It is not true.
Yeah, it is a myth that we can't. His claim is that it's a myth that we can effectively multitask. Mm-hmm. as anybody listening could probably assume, the claim of the benefits of being able to multitask, you know, you can just accomplish more in a shorter, you know, period of time. There's a lot to unpack here, so yeah. I'm just going to kind of run through it. So
absolutely.
If you have anything. The upside, obviously, is that there is a lot that can be accomplished. The downside is that you can actually accomplish very little if you're trained.
Or poorly done.
Or it's poorly done. Yeah, exactly. There's an analogy that I really liked. I heard it in a different podcast where, as we're multitasking, we're essentially information foraging. Mm. And so we are trying to go around and collect as much information and plug it into our system as quickly and as much of it as possible. And in this analogy, this podcaster compares it to animals foraging. And they go around and they're looking for food. And then once an environment, they've kind of extracted everything that they have, they quickly move on to the next environment where they can get more food. And we do the same thing with information and tasks, where we think if we just keep moving and foraging information and moving from one environment, we might go back to the environment because now there might be new food there. But what we fail to recognize are the opportunity costs, or what is kind of called switching costs, mm-hmm. between different tasks. How long, I mean, we've all done this as we're, you know, writing something, designing or developing something. You work on it for 15 minutes. Somebody comes over to your desk or, you know, gives you a call and you're like, oh my God, okay, let's jump into this. And then to re-engage in that other thing, the opportunity costs, you might think that you're multitasking because you're juggling a bunch of stuff. Too many places consider that like an asset with somebody, you know, in a
job
interview. Yeah, they
do. Well, yeah.
That's right? I can multitask.
It's the badge of honor,
right,
to like work
exactly.
extra hard or to multitask or to be able to manage and spin too many plates.
Yeah, totally. But are there real actual benefits of that? And what are you losing by the switching costs of moving between those tasks? And so the term is often confused because, Miriam, like you said, a lot of us think we're good at it.
Right.
And that we also think we're like drawn to it because we think we can get better at it as well.
Right.
And so there are two different ways to really look at attention. There's bottom-up attention and top-down attention. The bottom-up is kind of that processing that's occurring where, oh, my watch just buzzed. I can pay attention to that while I'm doing other things. It's kind of that residual background attention. But then there's that conscious attention that you're focusing on something. And we do this all the time. If somebody's listening to this and they're doing something while they're listening to the podcast, they can be doing another task. That's more behavioral though, right? That's not actual processing power. That's being committed to two things. And so like an analogy of this might even be, if you're driving down the road, you're listening to the podcast, you're actually paying attention to two things, right? You're paying attention to the road and the podcast. But the moment a deer jumps out, how many times I listen to podcasts whenever I drive to work, I often have to hit that back 15 seconds, 15 mm-hmm. seconds, because my attention had to move from the podcast to whatever car cut me off or whatever car I cut off. there's a difference in multitasking from parallel processing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we often talk about as multitasking, we're actually meaning parallel processing, and our brains are not wired to do that. They're wired to process one thing linear, not multiple things simultaneously, but we conflate that and we confuse those things a lot. And so that's why I find this super fascinating.
I was multitasking as Cade was speaking. I was just looking at our episode list. So for our listeners, episode 14, where we talked with Dr. Linda Havman about learning science, cognitive science. She spent a lot of time studying those things, and she breaks down a lot of like what's happening in my brain when mm-hmm. I'm trying to do that, and the connections that get broken. And I think it's true. I'm sure for both of you, I know some tasks that I'm working on, like I can listen to music. I found this so interesting. So I have a Spotify playlist I listen to all the time. I can listen to it even when I'm doing pretty intense work, like I'm writing something new or I'm studying something, because I've heard those songs so many times. Mm-hmm. They just play, like you said, in the background. But this is not a paid spot for Spotify.
Brought to you by Spotify.
They also have their like release radar, right? And so mm-hmm. on Mondays, I get this release radar of new songs by artists that I like. I cannot play those. when I need to be working on something. Because I'm like, wait, what? Totally. What is that song? Like, that's new. What are those words? I don't. And I think we all experience those kinds of things where our brain, the parallel processing doesn't work because we're trying to learn two things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to Spotify, I have the same thing where I can't listen to anything with words, mm-hmm. especially if I'm writing.
Yeah.
I can't listen to words because I can feel my attention shifting yep. between the two. But when I'm listening to something, if I'm kind of doing something passively on the other end, and I go, oh, if I start to pay attention at like the 2 minute mark, that's when I hit the little heart and I'm like, oh, I must like that. My brain must really like this one.
Cause you're listening. That's a good idea.
Yeah. It's like almost always like Johnny Swim or Bird Talk yeah, or something like that.
We have great conversations about music too.
Yeah. But that parallel processing mm-hmm. thing, I think is a point of confusion where we think we can get better at that. We can't, still human sapient, you know, Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. We're just not designed for that.
Well, and actually so the title of the book, Millennials, Goldfish, and Other Training Misconceptions, the goldfish comes from, and this is a huge point Quinn makes, and I'm not going to go to that chapter, but it's basically a myth that, oh, people have such short attention spans anymore. And it's exactly what you said. No, our brains are still the same. Same thing with serial and parallel processing. They were designed to function one way. Same thing with attention span. We still have the same attention span. What's changed in our world is that our distractions are greater and we allow them in. Mm-hmm. And then we build these habits of allowing them in and like, oh, I don't have an attention span anymore. Well, you do. You might have to work at it to bring it back, but it's the distractions
totally.
That are what you've let creep in.
It's that. So I had a conversation, Blaine, you might have been a part of that conversation a couple months ago with one of our directors, Ryan, where we're talking about deep work. Mm-hmm. And one of the solutions here of like what to do is allow design systems around yourself and your people, your community to allow for multitasking to not be a necessity
yes.
or a necessarily like a value, that badge of honor that you're talking about. Deep work, right? That's okay to have deep work to just focus in and, you know, kind of get siloed in some work. I don't know if you have any.
Yeah, I think it's just like you kind of said in the very beginning of this part of the conversation is it's almost like a badge of honor that people can mm-hmm. multitask, but it's become such a part of our culture and organizational cultures too, to have that badge of honor if you can do 1,000 things at once. And I think we have unfortunately gotten away from valuing that mm-hmm. heads down work, that deep work, what it looks like when it doesn't look like you're doing much because mm-hmm. you're thinking or you're strategizing or you're, you know, you're applying some of that stuff you just learned. I've definitely been a part of organizations that did value that. And mm-hmm. I can say that you can tell the difference in the output of places that allow you to just block off certain amount of time where turn your phone off, turn Slack off, turn whatever that is off where you can just focus on that and nobody's going to ask you to answer a question about a completely different topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of the growth of an organization too. We've seen that on the learning team in particular, like as things just evolved and people are asked to do too many things and they're in meetings, but they're also supposed to be writing storyboards or creating some kind of animation script or video script or... And we had to sort of make that pivot, and I'm not mm-hmm. sure we've done it 100% correctly yet, but to say, no, there's certain times that are completely blocked off,
yeah.
And you're not, jump and no, like you will decline those meetings
yep.
because you have to have time to really get in. Deep Work is actually an older book. It's on my current mm-hmm. list of audiobooks to listen to. I haven't mm-hmm. gotten to it yet. But.
There was a number of years ago when I was a lot earlier in my career, I was... a part of a monthly board meeting. And mm-hmm. as a part of that, you know, being young, wanting to really show value, add value, what I'm about to say relates to designing the system around mm-hmm. you. Where I remember one board meeting where I think I volunteered for probably 50% of the tasks.
Oh, right.
And,
yeah.
And we got done and I'll never forget the guy that pulled me aside. He's like, hey, look, big fella. you don't have to do that, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. You don't have to take all this on. And it was this moment of like, he was trying to create that system around me because I was about to not do any of it well.
Right.
Exactly.
And so it was kind of like, find what you're best at, mm-hmm. you know, and get into that deep work with those 2 to 3 things. I didn't need to be the person that went and found the EKG for the department. I was like, I'll
yes.
do it.
But
that was really helpful for me to somebody to create that system around me.
No, I love that. That's a great example. Thank you so much, Blaine and Cade. I love your insight. I mean, so we covered four, which means if I do my math correct, there's 33 other topics here. Again, the type of book you can take to the beach, read a chapter, pull it off your shelf later. I actually love this book because it'll be even a random conversation. Somebody will say something. I'm like, I don't think that's right. I grab the book off the shelf and take a look again. But I'd also encourage our listeners to read the book with a discerning eye, which is what you both have done. Like, you may or may not agree with everything, which is the way it should be. So I am excited to get to my favorite part of podcasts. We often ask at the end, what are you learning well now? And since I have such great conversations with both of you over books and music and just life, I'm excited to hear what you're learning well now. And I kind of just threw this at Blaine, so I'm going to have Key go first because he is a little more prepared. What are you learning well now? Our listeners are curious. They're lifelong learners, and something you say might just trigger something in them that they're going to be excited to go off and learn.
Well, I don't know that it's something anybody else is going to find interesting.
Maybe I didn't set the parameters correctly on this brainstorming session.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm reading a book by her name's Mary Beard. It's called The 12 Caesars.
Okay.
And she has a really, really good book called SPQR that I read at the end of last year. This other book, it's The 12 Caesars. What it just basically does is looks at the visualization, the representation of this idea or role of Caesar throughout history, across different societies, and how we've memorialized images, relics, personas, and just the concept of a Caesar, and how we've kind of let that permeate not only like social values, but political values, organizational values. So to me, it's pretty interesting, but that's kind of like a little bit of the history nerd in me.
No. So what I'm actually curious about then as a learner, like, how did you even hear about, you know what I'm saying? It seems kind of niche. I know you're a history nerd and all that. I love history too. I'm probably not going to read the 12 Caesars again, but
yeah.
So I'm curious, and you're thinking like, what, as a learner, what drew you to that? How did you hear about it and what drew you to it?
So at the beginning of every year, I choose a number of topics that I'm interested in. Generally, it's like 3 to 4 topics for the year, and I build out a reading list for those topics.
I love that.
And so as I'm at, you know, a bookstore or wherever, I can take a picture, and I have a separate album on my phone for next year's topics.
Oh, that's very cool.
And so this just kind of fit in. I wanted to learn a little bit more about the classics and ancient Roman history. So this kind of fit right into there.
Oh, I love that. And we've talked about various podcasts we listen to about what should you read next, and just other ones. So, but I think that's, as lifelong learners, it's interesting to not just maybe, again, information overload, right? Like, we can just grab at the latest, greatest all the time, or like, what are topics I'm interested in now that would really further my thinking? Or, so I know Jerry, who's on this podcast sometimes, he's always reading a nonfiction book. He's reading a history book in like one other category. I can't remember now, but he has like 3 categories that he's constantly reading. So having some kind of plan.
Yeah, I do the same. I have a topic for different category, different genres of literature. This year's history one was ancient Rome.
Okay. I think I hear another podcast coming.
Yeah.
All right, Blaine, what about you? What are you learning well now?
Kate stole my idea, so I am also reading a book.
Not the 12 Caesars, I'm assuming. Okay.
No. You're reading the 12 Caesars, too?
I am not, sir. I'm reading a book called The Sleeping Beauties, and it's actually written by a neurologist who travels all over the world looking at these very specific illnesses that cannot be explained simply through lab tests and things like that. So it is a bit of a beach read itself because each chapter is a different illness that she went and studied.
Okay.
She does thread them through, like she'll talk about the differences as she kind of goes through it, but you can absolutely just pick one up and be interested in it. So it's very unique because each of those, again, they can't be explained through lab tests. It has to do with the environment. It has to do with the culture they're in. Mm. It has to do with the scenario that they're all in. Mm-hmm. But you know, what's really interesting is that, again, it's all connected. And we really like to see the problem is this. I did this blood test. It came back this, and that's your problem. And that just doesn't explain everything. So you have
a Western kind of way of thinking to approaching medicine, or you think?
It's probably prevalent in Western culture, but she is traveling all over the world, and they still have that same kind of mindset. And again, I think it's just we want things to be simple. Our brains want to take the complex and make it easier. But unfortunately, that's just not the case. And so you actually have to look at more of the sociology and anthropology and all the things that connect to what the people who are who have this illness are going through and what that really means for them. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very interesting, and there are like no solutions to it. No, everybody's just kind of like, it just is what it is. It's when they're going through this in this place in this time, this is what it looks like. And actually one of them right now, it's called Havana syndrome, which is actually coming back around. So it started in Cuba, but it is, they've seen it in Paris recently. And I think some other place too.
Is that the headaches?
And yeah. It's like some people heard a really loud noise and some people heard nothing, but it's like, they're getting headaches. They're getting a little dizzy. It's always U.S. Diplomats and embassies and other, and so they cannot explain it. And they've tried to figure out, like, is it, you know, all these different possible, like, sort of like terrorism acts, and they still can't explain it.
That's really so. I'm going to ask you the same thing. Do you make like a book list at the beginning of the year based on topics, or what led you to grab that book?
I actually bought it for my dad for Christmas.
Okay.
And then he read it, thought I would really like it, and then gave it back to me to read.
That's so interesting you say that. And this podcast will be released after Father's Day, unfortunately. But as we were talking through the previous book, I was like, my dad would love this book. I'm going to give it to him. Yeah. So that's always fun too, I think. So. Well, thank you both for sharing what you're learning well. I love that there were two books. It's timely with our beach reads. I think we have found fodder for some other podcasts. Yeah. But I also want to thank our audience. We thank you so much for listening. We know that your time is a gift, and we thank you for choosing to spend it with us. If you want to interact more with us, you can look on MindSpring's Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, whenever we release the Learning Well podcast. We'd love to interact more with you. Make sure to comment, like, and subscribe as always, but thank you again for the gift of your time.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.